Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Jason Shulman. We've got a great show for you today. My guest is Sven-Erik Rose, who teaches at UC Davis. Here to talk about his new book, Jewish Philosophical Politics in Germany, 1789 to 1848, published in 2014 by Brandeis University Press. Sven-Erik, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Hi, man. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's great to have you. So maybe let's start, if you would, tell us broadly and briefly about 1789 and 1848. Those are two revolutionary years in Europe. What happened between those two turning points for the Jews of Europe? And did it have any special meaning for the Jews of Germany?
Right. So a lot happened for the Jews of Europe, for Western Europe especially. So especially in France, with the French Revolution, which you alluded to, which began in 1789. That really was the moment when Jews entered the state. Not exactly in 1789. It took until 1791 and a lot of debate in the French Parliament, in the National Assembly. But eventually, the Jews did get citizenship in France. And so that was really kind of raised the anticipation of some movement on Jewish civil rights in Germany. Now, in contradistinction to what happened in France, this was a very long and drawn out and piecemeal negotiation in Germany. So there was a kind of hope and a sort of realistic, well, it's the expectation seemed more realistic that Jews could achieve civil rights, what was commonly called emancipation in Germany, although that didn't really play out. It took almost a century of kind of discourse and expectation and work on that before Jews got the same rights as other citizens in Germany, not until 1871 in the aftermath of the Franco-Prussian War. But it did certainly raise the expectations and the kind of hopes and the kind of energy around the issue of Jewish emancipation in German countries.
And 1848 also held the promise, not realized, though. Is that right?
That's correct. So 1848, that was the other part of your question, the end of my period. That was the year of a failed revolution in Germany. So a liberal revolution. German liberals were hoping to consolidate a German country with a parliament. And they tried to do that, and they set up a pre-parliament and then finally an assembly in Frankfurt. And in the end, they didn't have any power, and the project fell in 1849, and basically reverted to what had been there before. But a lot of Jews were involved in this effort, and it was the kind of first time that Jews were prominently, played a real prominent role in a major political effort in Germany. And so that was also, sort of a failed revolution, but it consolidated, say, the Jewish identification with German liberalism in a way that certainly a lot of Jews had identified with the liberal kind of project in Germany before that. But there had been some holdouts. A lot of the Orthodox community was not so sold on German liberalism. In the wake of 1848 and onward, you really had German Jews thought of themselves as precisely that, as German Jews, and looking for citizenship and tending to, say, denationalize Jewish identity into a more religious identity where they would be German citizens of the Jewish faith or the Mosaic faith or what have you. So it was a real turning point, even though it didn't result in immediate political gains. It may even have set the process back, according to some historians. But in terms of identity, it was certainly a major turning point.
What is philosophical politics, and why is it something that Jews were particularly interested in during these 60 years?
Right. So philosophical politics is a term that I came up with myself to talk about a certain kind of tendency in Jewish German thought in this period. And I consider it a variation of a broader theme in German philosophical culture in general. So I don't think what the Jewish intellectuals are doing in this period is completely different than what's going on in the broader culture. But I think it's perhaps there is a difference. And what's going on in the broader culture is precisely Germans and German intellectuals see what's going on the other side of the Rhine in France, and they say, wow, you know, political modernity has all this possibilities, both great potential that we can welcome and a lot of dangers like the terror in the French Revolution, or depending on your politics, Napoleon. But at any rate, the sense that history was momentous and could really change, that politics could really evolve and quite rapidly and transform the world as it was known at the time. And on the other hand, in Germany, what you have is kind of political stagnation. It's sort of compared to France, it's sort of politically a backwater. But what you do have is a revolution in thinking. This is the period between Kant and Hegel and the young Hegelians in the 1830s and 40s, including people like Karl Marx and Moses Hess. That this is a real flowering of thought, of philosophical thinking in Germany. So there's a kind of intellectual revolution that's going on in German countries, but doesn't really have any. Not much going on politically. And so there's a kind of compensatory role that philosophy can play in German culture, that intellectuals kind of think through philosophical models to kind of compensate for the lack of real political opportunities. And like I said, I think that's going on, and kind of political theorizing through philosophical paradigms is something that is going on broadly. But Jews are doubly marginalized. They have to sort of think of themselves or think ways that they might be able to belong to the wider polity in the first place, let alone change that polity in a way that would be more progressive and on its way to a more modern political state, which was a broader problem. But whether or not Jews could even be part of that political project was in question. And a number of the Jewish intellectuals that I look at in this book are drawing on powerful philosophical models to do precisely that, to try to think of a polity in which Jews could participate.
Yeah, so these Jewish intellectuals that you look at are thinking about Judaism with the tools, you say, of the German philosophical tradition. Can you tell us just sort of briefly, what are some of the most important elements of German philosophy at the time?
Sure. So the main paradigms that I look at are Kant, and we have in one chapter that I deal with is a Jewish Kantian named Lazarus ben David, and he's drawing on Kant's moral philosophy, which is a philosophy that stresses human freedom and autonomy. So he's looking at the sort of free, autonomous, moral subject. That is that the for Kant, the moral subject is free in the sense that we should not be beholden to any moral standard that we don't create for ourselves. We're sort of autonomously, in moral terms, we're self-legislating, and that's what he means by autonomy. And so Ben David kind of thinks of citizenship in these terms. He thinks that if you have a rational, autonomous subject, then that kind of subject would be fit for citizenship in a modern German state, which of course doesn't really exist anywhere, right? That's not on the table. Nobody's saying if you Jews reform yourselves and become rational according to the Kantian model, then we will give you citizenship rights. That's not really a realistic negotiation, but it's a kind of a vision and a hope. And perhaps, you know, with the kind of tumultuous political climate, something that seemed somewhat plausible, that some kind of real change could happen. But that's one model is Kant and the kind of autonomous subjectivity, and that taken as a kind of model for political citizenship in one era. And then the next powerful model that I look at is Hegel, the great idealist philosopher of the 19th century in Germany. He died in 1831. And he is important for a group of young Jewish intellectuals that were, for the most part, first-generation university students at the University of Berlin. And this group of Hegelian sort of inspired intellectuals, they sort of shuttled between Hegel's lecture hall and their own meetings of an association that they began in Berlin in 1819, and it existed through the mid 1820s, and it was called the Association for the Culture of the Culture and Study of the Jews, or the Science of the Jews. Wissenschaft is the German term, and this group has a kind of an important place in Jewish studies as a discipline, and that is that they invented the term Wissenschaft des Judentums. That's either, like I said, science of Judaism or the academic study of Judaism. And so they are kind of looked at as one origin for a secular approach, an academic approach to Jewish studies. They were very sort of vehemently, self-consciously separating themselves from the rabbinic tradition of Jewish learning and trying to take on the latest academic standards and methodologies to study Jewish cultural history. So they are really inspired by Hegel and his whole kind of conception of how rationality unfolds in history. And we can talk more about that, but there was a real political edge to it. So what I look at in my book, like I said, there's a kind of this group and this institution has been enshrined in the history of Jewish studies as one kind of origin for what we still do in the discipline of Jewish studies. But my focus on the book is actually not so much on the production of actual Jewish scholarship, which is very important in its own right, but rather on the political investments that they had in their institution, which is a fairly humble kind of institution, actually. But they, withdrawing on Hegelian theory, invested it with a lot of political hopes that they would become the mediators between the Jewish community and the state, that they would kind of incorporate the Jews as participants in a modern, forward-looking, progressive state. They didn't have any real leg to stand on to do this. They were kind of going on Hegelian theory and chutzpah, and had a very little support from the Jewish community in whose interest they claimed to operate, and they had very little access to any centers of power within the Prussian state. But what they had was Hegelian theory and a Hegelian theory of the state, and so they kind of existed in this very interesting gray zone between the reality of the Prussian state, and which was quite reactionary and eventually excluded Jews from state service, although that was a bit ambiguous during the existence of this association. And they existed in sort of the gray zone between the real state and Hegel state. And for them, the Hegelian state, which was much more attractive than the real existing Prussian state, seemed more real to them in a very interesting way. I think that they thought that they were kind of on the right side of history, that their ideas would prevail, that their vision for a progressive state based on the kind of model that Hegel had theorized was in some sense the future, and the reactionary tendencies in the Prussian state were not going to exist much longer, that the writing was on the wall, that they understood what was happening, they understood the movement of history and where they were going. Unfortunately, they were wrong about that. Mm-hmm. But Hegel is the major thinker for them. And then I'll just more briefly, I have a chapter on the young Marx, where he's sort of his own thinker. He also is engaging with Hegel. That's we can talk about that chapter. It doesn't fit the schema in quite the same way as the other chapters, which are all Jewish thinkers trying to sort of use a philosophical set of tools to imagine a polity in which Jews could participate. And so I'll hop over the Marx for a moment. I'm happy to come back to you.
Sure. Maybe we'll come back to Marx. But let me ask you about the group. They put German philosophy towards sort of a Jewish end. They're trying to reimagine Jewish history, community, and political agency. How exactly are they trying to do that? How are they using Kantianism and German idealism towards that end? And what kind of response did they get? These were pretty marginal folks at the time, right?
That's correct. Yeah, these are all thinkers that don't have any real position within the Jewish community. So they are, and I think that's important, that they are kind of using German philosophy from a position of relative weakness, right? That it's a bit of a fantasy, I think, in a kind of compensatory role that German philosophy is playing for them. I think when you have real pragmatic sort of possibilities to maneuver, you may not have to resort to elaborate theoretical arguments and visions if you want. But they're on the one hand, I think that there was a sort of a sense that this thought by Kant and by Hegel, which were really new. I think it's an important thing to remember when these particular intellectuals, Lazarus Ben David and the group of the Association of the Study of Jewish Culture, when they were working with these ideas, these were very new, innovative ideas. They've become sort of part of intellectual history and you know, part of curriculum, so we don't really think of them as so radically new, but they were right there at the beginning. And I think that they really sort of thought that these ideas were unlocking a kind of potential for the way that modernity was going to unfold. So there was a definite kind of overestimation of the power of thought itself. I think that they sort of thought that these powerful ideas were going to, sweep away a lot of the antiquated structures of absolutism and the kind of backward quality of the German political situation. So a kind of harnessing their political project to this engine of radically new philosophical thought, which, you know, in the end is not a very good motor to harness your politics too. But it's an interesting thing that happened and something that I was really quite fascinated with.
Just sort of briefly, what until now has been sort of the accepted view of how Jews interacted with German philosophy? It seems like you're trying to turn it on its head, and, you know, your explanation better explains why Ben David should be better known.
Right. Well, there's a couple things that I do sort of upend. And one sort of standard narrative about the Jewish reception of Kant and of Hegel, and Spinoza is the other important figure in my book, that is a bit different because he wasn't a contemporary, of course, but his reception was important. But Kant and Hegel in particular, it's fairly standard to think that Kant was kind of the philosopher that German Jews adopted almost as sort of the good German philosopher with whom they could work. You find a long history of Jewish Kantians kind of seeing analogies or harmonies between Jewish ethics and Kantian ethics, or at least purporting to see these harmonies. And Hermann Cohen, who died during the First World War as an older professor, but he was sort of at the end of this history of Jewish Kantians, and he almost saw Judaism and Kantianism sort of intellectually as very, very similar. And so that's kind of been one standard take. And then the other one is that Jewish studies has tended to be very reticent towards Hegel. And this for some good reason. Hegel wrote some things in his youth, some essays that trafficked in quite negative anti-Jewish stereotypes of Jews as being misanthropic and egoistic. These were not published during his lifetime, so the members of the association that I talk about weren't familiar with them. But in his general philosophy, he also has a kind of secularized Christian supersessionism. So that is to say that you know, he secularizes this narrative of Christianity having come and made Judaism obsolete. But in intellectual terms, in secular terms, it's doing much of the same thing. There's not a lot of reason why Judaism, within a Hegelian narrative of the unfolding of history, why Judaism should still be around and continue to exist. So there are very good reasons for skepticism vis-a-vis Hegel. But I try to put some pressure on that in some ways by showing that that Kant, as Ben David takes him up, I don't want to be heard as saying that, you know, the opposite, that Kant is bad for the Jews and Hegel is good for the Jews. I would say that, you know, to the question, is Kant good or bad for the Jews, I would say yes, and I would say the same thing about Hegel. But I do show that the first person really to draw on Kant, Ben David, to kind of think through a Jewish politics, if you want, ends in a very ambivalent place, and one that shows the dangers of Kantian universalism for Jews. He has a gruesome metaphor that I study at some length in my chapter of decapitation. He says that traditional Judaism is a hydra, all of whose heads have to be severed at once, instantaneously, in order to kind of fix Judaism and make it, adequate to the modern age and to modern citizenship. And this really comes from a Kantian paradigm of universalism, that ethics is, for Kant, we are free and self-legislating, but what constitutes the ethical is its ability to be universalized, so that if we act in a way that we would want everyone to act, then that is sort of the sine qua non of a moral maxim, right? That's sort of what makes something moral in Kant. Well, that makes it very difficult to negotiate with, say, any kind of alternate or alterity, any kind of ethical alterity. So what does traditional Jewish ethics look like that from a Kantian perspective? Well, only as something that has to be eradicated, arguably. So it's a real dangerous kind of proposition, that there's no real content to Kantian morality, more a structure of universalization that makes it moral. And then so that's a danger, I think. So I'm sort of upending that sense that Kant is sort of good for the Jews and saying, well, it's in some ways, yes, but also very complicated. And then with Hegel being very problematic for Jewish thinkers to appropriate, there's one crucial thing, a couple of crucial things that I think are sometimes not appreciated. And one is that whereas Kant thought of the subject, right, the moral autonomous subject was the centerpiece for his thinking, Hegel really has critiqued subjectivism in many different kinds of forms, and was really a theoretician of collective ethical communities. And in that sense, Jews, he opens up a space to think about Jews as a community, that not everyone has to be simply an individual subject, a universal kind of generic subject, like the Kantian rational moral subject. And so that gave these Jewish thinkers a way to think of what would the Jewish community look like as a community, and how could it fit into an ethical community of the state. So that was one important thing. And then the other important thing that I think Hegel sort of offered to these thinkers was, yes, he does say that everything has to have a kind of rational explanation, that it has, that the state has to be a rational entity, and that there are certain things that do get superseded. But if you can sort of find a rational core to Judaism, which sort of, if you want, justifies its continuing existence, then it can have a place in Hegel's state. And they thought very much that they could look at Jewish history and find a kind of rational core and harmonize it with the sort of requirements of the Hegelian conception of the state. So there are, and also Hegel was within the context of 1820s Germany, for all of the ways that he is absolutely sort of problematic for Jewish studies or for Jewish identity, I guess. He was really a progressive. I mean, he spoke out against anti-Semitism, and he spoke out against sort of ethnic or folkish conceptions of the polity, and he said explicitly that Jews should be admitted to civil service and things like that. So he was in many ways certainly not a perfect ally, but definitely a kind of an ally. So those are some of the ways that I think I'm sort of upending some of the standard narratives of the way that Kant and Hegel have re-echoed through Jewish philosophy.
Consider them upended. I do want to come back to Marx, who we touched on, and you mentioned that chapter, chapter 4, is slightly different in sort of the structure, the schema, although I do want to be conscious of the time. Tell us what's going on with Marx and Bauer. What do we need to know?
Okay, well, I'll try to do this briefly, as you sort of indicated, the time is running short. So Bauer, there's a famous, infamous essay by Marx called On the Jewish Question, and it is formally a review of some essays by Bruno Bauer. Bruno Bauer, you know, wrote an essay against giving civil rights to Jews, to giving them the same sort of citizenship rights in Germany as non-Jews enjoyed. And this was really going against the standard liberal consensus that Jews should be admitted to citizenship. And so Marx takes this opportunity to write against Bauer, but it's somewhat a kind of engagement with Bauer, but it's really, I think, an opportunity for Marx to say some things that he's been working through. And the reason why this is in a sort of infamous piece is that Marx, in the second half of his essay, resorts to some very ugly anti-Jewish rhetoric, calling Jews, you know, bodily and egoistic and venal. And it's really quite striking how just kind of dripping with anti-Jewish sentiment this piece suddenly becomes. And so that's been kind of a conundrum. It's a very important pivotal piece for Marx in his path towards getting to historical materialism. And so it's an important piece. It's in every major, you know, anthology of early Marx, of the early Marx's writings. And it's been sort of notorious within Jewish studies as how do we interpret this? And different interpretations have been that Marx is writing out of Jewish self-hatred or usually that. That's been a kind of consistent sort of essay that people have gone back to and tried to understand from various points of view. And I try to understand it differently. So I try to not understand it from a psychological point of view. Why is Marx, you know, saying such nasty things about Jews? But what is this decision to say such nasty things about Jews doing in his theoretical development? So I try to talk about what is the sort of function of the deployment of this anti-Jewish rhetoric in Marx's development. And the very short version of that is that Marx had at that point come to critique politics, which had before kind of been his go-to solution to how do you get something done? How do you accomplish something? How do you get out of this mere philosophical abstraction that a lot of us, he saw his contemporaries sort of stuck in? And how do you really change something in the world? Well, for a long time, he thought that politics was the way. And at this point, he's come to sort of move beyond liberal politics, and he's moving to radicalization and towards socialism and communism and revolution, right? Not politics, but as we sort of common political activity, but rather social revolution. And so politics has become this empty category, and he's saying that the political state is just another version of religion. It's just a political heaven. You have rights, but they don't mean anything. And so we need something that is an alternative to this empty, evacuated category of the political, and that has to be the social. And yet he doesn't yet have his real theory of production and what we now sort of associate with Marxism. That's not in place yet. And so really what he has is a rhetorical gambit to kind of give himself the sense and the illusion of talking from a place that's very real, as opposed to abstract and ethereal. And the way that he can sort of gain purchase on this reality, or this the pseudo reality, if you want, is to make the figure of the real Jew, which is his phrase, the real Jew, as opposed to the theological Jew or the Jew of belief, but the real social embodied Jew, the more that he abuses that figure, the more leverage he gets from that figure, that he can say that he's speaking from a place of reality. So I call it a kind of an abusive embrace of the figure of the Jew, that it's a term of abuse, but as much as the more he abuses that figure, the more obscene he makes that figure, the more he kind of gains from that figure. He can embrace that figure and use it as a platform from which to be speaking from some kind of solid social reality rather than an ethereal political set of illusions.
I think you captured that very briefly and succinctly. Thank you. Sven Erik, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. The book is Jewish Philosophical Politics in Germany, 1789 to 1848, published in 2014 by Brandeis University Press. The author, Sven Erik Rose. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.